You're listening to the program Saskia Unreserved on RIC Classic. We cross over now to Dr. Gabby Gunders from the University of Western Australia, and who is also the founder and director of Performance Courage Lab. You'll understand why later, because Dr. Gunders has just completed research on music performance anxiety, discussing how expectances, reflections, and emotions impact music performance anxiety in collaborative settings. And collaborative settings is another part of the research which follows on from her master's research, where she discussed that as well and looked into the essence of pianistic collaboration, examining what it actually is, the kind of repertoire that's played. So we'll touch on that as well. Are there lots of similarities between the experiences of performance anxiety amongst musicians and athletes, and phenomena that have been discussed in relation to musicians, like increased heart rates, shaking limbs, excessive sweating, overthinking, a loss of concentrated attention that potentially leads to avoidance and declined quality of life or performance, affects athletes in similar ways to musicians. So it's, of course, imperative to understand this, and her research is very, very important. A very warm welcome to the program, Dr. Gunders. It's wonderful to have you all the way from Australia. Thank you for staying up late.
Thank you so much, Saskia. It's an absolute delight to be on your program.
I'd like to begin with your beginning into the world of music and whether you hail from a musical family.
Well, before I get to my family, I actually, you know, as Maria Joao Pires was finishing the Beethoven Fourth, I nearly started clapping because I just loved her playing so much. And the very first time I actually heard her was the Beethoven Fourth. And when she performed that, and for the first, you know how the first movement starts with this extraordinary piano solo, and I just couldn't breathe. And at the end, as the orchestra was coming in, I started breathing again. And
yes.
And after that, I think I bought every single recording she's ever recorded. I just love her sense of melody and tone and balancing and layering. And
yeah. So wonderful.
back to my family. Yes. So no. I know that I was born in Jerusalem, but my family, half of it is originally from Germany and half of it is from Austria. And so my paternal side, my grandmother was a violinist, and she had played before they kind of escaped to Israel. She had played violin, I think she was in the Bamberg Orchestra. And I know that my grandfather from the maternal side, he was an amateur musician. He was a photographer by profession. He was an amateur musician. And I think my love of collaboration, absolutely, of collaborative piano, absolutely started with the endless four hands that we used to play when I was a child. And my mom played. So that was kind of part of my childhood. She was always playing.
Was it a natural development that you were going to be a musician? Did you ever think, oh, I'm going to do something else?
Yes, I was toying with languages and being a translator. I was toying with that and then carrying on playing and kind of continuing with the piano for the love of it, which, by the way, circles back to Maria Joao Pires, because she apparently, I remember in one of the interviews, she once said, I'm an amateur musician, you know, amare, I just love what I do. And so I was thinking of being a simultaneous translator, and then kind of last minute decided music was going to be it.
And then from Jerusalem, you moved to South Africa, and you
That's
began your music degree,
which is where we met.
Yes.
And so I did a piano performance degree and a Bachelor of Music with Honours. And that was, while it was piano performance, I also the majority kind of my interest during those years was to accompany. I was just accompanying and collaborating with anyone and everyone. And that was during my studies, and then certainly for the next few decades, that was the bread and butter, and that was also my biggest love, collaborative playing. And so I, after following my studies, I kind of in a few countries and so on, I just collaborated, and I was, for a few years, I was working only with singers, so a lot of compositeur work, and then kind of moved more to the instrumental side, and then it kind of never was both together at the same time. And then the last few years that I was collaborating as a profession, that was all instrumentalist. So a lot of strings players, lots of cello, lots of violin repertoire. And then it was actually quite sudden that I, in the middle of accompanying a recital with someone, in the middle of the eighth, I think, Beethoven piano and violin sonata, I kind of thought, no, it's my turn now, and I'm done playing everybody else's music, and made quite a few really substantial changes in my life at that point.
Wow. You've used the term collaborative pianist. I know that that is a progression of your master's degree as well. It's not a term that's used in academia. Well, it's a quite recent term, let's put it that way. I just would like you to explain to our listeners how it differs from being an accompanist, because so many people just use the term accompanist, and of course so much of the repertoire is where the pianist is actually has the role of partner. I mean, if we think of the Brahms piano cello sonatas, the Strauss Debussy sonata, your equals.
Exactly. And I think this is possibly a progression that is pretty much aligned with other things that kind of humanity is going through in terms of equality. So in the old days, the piano was a sidekick. There were times a long time ago with a pianist in a, for example, Liederabend. So if there was a concert where it was all out song and there would have been a singer on the stage, the pianist would have been behind the screen.
Yes.
And then the next stage was, of course, that they'd be on the screen, but either the name wouldn't be mentioned or the font was tiny on the publicity material, or they would make sure that the pianist was kind of dressed in a lesser kind of,
yes,
let's say, elegant dress than the actual soloist, and so on and so on. And slowly the whole process, together with the upskilling of these pianists, so the field was known to be kind of taken by people who kind of couldn't crack it as solo pianists. And slowly, this is more and more an understanding that it actually takes a certain personality to perform this task. And to be a good collaborator needs personality that is kind of less, more just collaborative, more cooperating, and more an ability to say, this is not about me, this is about us, and us becoming together more than we could be just each of us separate.
I think it's such an important word, not only in the music world, but all around, whether it's business, whether it's politics, wherever, family. Collaboration is, of course, key to everything. What is it that led to your interest in performance anxiety? Was there something specific that led you to that?
Yes, I think it's less something specific, and more over the years I had collaborated and accompanied so many people who suffered, who literally sat there either backstage trembling you know, I named two of those as an introductory in my dissertation, in my thesis. I kind of named two. The one of the first times, and one of them is not in a collaboration. One of them is one of my students when I just started teaching at the University of Western Australia. And there was a piano evening, a piano recital. And I'd gone backstage to kind of wish everyone, and especially my students, to go and kind of see how they're doing and wish them all the best and so on. Mm. And one of my students was all huddled up kind of into herself and kind of, you know, absolutely expecting the worst to happen. And so, and, you know, saying things like, I'm going to die, I'm going to die. And course, and I said to her, you're not going to die, you're going to breathe, and then you're going to go on stage and you're going to play, and either it'll be wonderful or it'll be a little bit less wonderful, but regardless, it's going to finish, you're going to go home. And putting, you know, putting back, and of course that was at the time before I did this research, and now I know a whole lot more,
yes,
about it all. And of course the whole thing, there was another example that I gave there, that somebody had wanted me to accompany a teenage boy, and the mum had said, can you please squeeze him in? When I said I could not fit him in, there was just no way I could take on any more rehearsals and learning music at the moment because my schedule was full for that month. And she said, please, can you try and fit him in? He really feels safe with you.
Right.
And I was thinking, okay, so now it's time to decode, what is this feeling safe all about? What is that he couldn't do on his own?
Yes.
And so it was this kind of thing, and then many, many more instances. But I think that generally, if you ask musicians, what is it that you love about this profession? But then you ask them, what is it that you dislike about this profession? You would find that many, many, many of them, if not the vast majority, is going to tell you that the pre-performance anxiety actually is just sometimes a good enough reason to consider leaving the profession.
Mm. I love the multidisciplinary aspect of your research, which involved not only the musicians themselves, but also the psychological and neurological aspects of music making. So although, as you say, a definition of performance anxiety probably depends on who you ask, can you outline what actually happens to the person with anxiety?
Of course. So what actually happens to us is something that has been happening to us for millions and millions and millions of years, simply because we have a brain that's got an amygdala. And the amygdala is this tiny little, you know, almond-shaped and sized structure that we have in both hemispheres. It sits slightly behind, in the brain, slightly behind the eyes and inwards from the ears. And all that it does all the time, and it's been doing that for many, many hundreds of millions of years, it is scanning for danger. And so the whole time, it looks for danger all the time, and it finds it. Now, what is that? That on its own is a perfect thing because it keeps us safe, and it has kept us safe. The moment we are alerted to this danger, we can do what is known as the stress response, as the fight or flight, or fight or flight and freeze. And now they have the please and appease as well that they've discovered.
Mm.
But what happens is that that moment we can do, there's a whole set of responses that happen at that time along the, with a whole lot of hormones that are released in response. But what happens then is, you know, a much later development in the brain is the prefrontal cortex. And the prefrontal cortex is the one that that is able to kind of project into the future, and no other animal can actually do that. Humans are the only ones with the prefrontal cortex. We're the only ones that can actually project into the future. So we're the only ones who can actually catastrophize. We're the only ones who can
yes.
say, but what if this happens? And so, you know, the moment we are backstage and we've got the shaking limbs and we've got the shallow breath and we've got the heart rate that is going up and our mouth goes dry and our vision is, you know, the pupils are dilated. sweated and the palms get sweaty and all, and we run to the bathroom. All these things are really important in the stress response, and all those have got their own reasons within the stress response why they actually happen. But psychologically, we also have that, you know, that fear of being and of being judged, and we have this fear of making mistakes, and that what if that I spoke about, it just goes round and round like cyclical, you know, a cyclical thought pattern that we can't escape, and we catastrophize, and we have this feeling of panic and out of control. And so very often people feel all these things and they say, no, this is not for me.
Mm.
But of course, the stress response is actually a when we know how to use all these things positively, and how to frame, how to use reframing, and how to use the work around mindsets that has been done and is being done, just amazing research, then we can use those things and not let them harm not our well-being and not our performance.
Is there a link between MPA and social anxiety? I saw that you had very interesting stats on orchestral players in Australia with actually 33% presenting social phobias, which I thought was a pretty high number and percentage for orchestral members, because I would have thought that it mostly affected soloists and collaborative players, I can understand as well, in the smaller ensembles, because there's a huge responsibility there as well.
Yeah. So the link between social anxiety and MPA has been shown over and over. And in fact, music performance anxiety is termed together with social anxiety, used to be, and now they've taken it out from the, you know, the American Psychological Association kind of breakdowns of all their kind of codes and diseases. But
yes,
the research that you're talking about is actually, it's fascinating and sad in equal amounts. These are people like Bronwyn Ackerman and Diana Kenny and others who have done this research, I think, in 2012 or 2014. I think they published that particular paper in 2014. Mm. And they have got, I think they 377, I think, musicians from orchestras around Australia. We've got all these, you know, every capital city has got its state orchestra. And so they had 377, and the amount of suffering that was visible in there, but not only the actual suffering, we're talking about comorbidities with depression, with PTSD, with anxiety disorder, and also the scary statistic of how many of them regularly use beta blockers.
Wow.
And
that's alarming.
And that is absolutely alarming.
Mm.
Absolutely alarming. And you asked me before kind of what led you to this research. I very recently met someone, and she said to me, so what was this PhD all about? And I told her what it was about, and she told me this story that is, there are just so many like it. But when her daughter was 15, she very studied. She was a young trumpeter in high school. She was doing a whole lot of things. One of them was playing trumpet. And she came to me one day and said, Mom, I'm really nervous. I'm not going to be able to play. I don't think I can play in this concert. And Mom said, go and speak to your teacher. And the teacher heard that and said, go to the pharmacy, get beta blockers. It was that simple. And so the daughter came home and said to Mom, the teacher said I should take beta blockers. And so Mom went to the pharmacy and said, what are beta blockers? And when she heard what they were, which are just, this is medication that is given to people who've got tachycardia, which is when the heart palpitations are way too high. So it's a cardiac medication. And so she said to the daughter, there's no way that you're going to take this kind of medication. But the reality is, and the daughter, unfortunately, she's studying to be a pharmacist at the moment. She's studying pharmacology. She's 22. But the reality is she never played again.
Right. I think that also few people know about Pavarotti's MPA, or even how it kept Barbara Streisand away from
absolutely.
The stage. Can you recount briefly what led to that? And also to discuss
yes.
the difference between stage fright and MPA, mm-hmm. because not the same.
Yeah, so Barbara Streisand, in the 60s, there was a performance that she had. There were upwards of 200,000 people, I think, that was in Central Park. And she was singing her songs, and in the middle, she had a memory lapse. She could not remember the words to her own song. And this humiliation kept her away from the stage for 27 years. Which is, again, I mean, the tragedy of that, for 27 years, nobody could just go and have this absolute joy of enjoying a performance of her. She went on recording and acting and writing, but she didn't perform again until 27 years later, they had the prompt. And so the
yes.
words were running all the time as she was singing, and she started performing again. Now, the whole thing between stage fright and music performance anxiety is kind of, it's not actually that simple, and there are many, many, many of the researchers who are actually saying we need the clarity around the terminology because it is so unclear.
Yes.
And so stage fright is basically... There isn't, you know, if you consider all the input from all the researchers, there isn't actually a clear answer of which is which. The way I finish my dissertation and what I actually mention in some of my workshops that I do as part of the Performance Courage Lab is that I personally do not think that music performance anxiety is a suitable term. I think it is actually doing us a lot of harm.
Ah.
Because the moment we speak about anxiety, we pathologize it.
That's true.
We make it as if something is wrong. And so if we have a look at something which is the basis of research, the basis of a lot of the research around anxiety, this is something that was discovered in 1908 or something, and that is the Jurgensen-Dodson theory, which some people consider the Jurgensen-Dodson law. And that is, it is an inverted U diagram that is used, first of all, for anxiety research, but also in terms of optimal performance among sports people, it is used all the time. And so they say that a certain amount of stress is really conducive to how well the performance is going to go, or the
yes.
effort, how good the effort is going to be that is put in. And so there is an optimal stage of that inverted U where the best performance gets given or the best effort is put in practice and so on. But then if there is too much pressure, then the quality of the performance drops again. The whole thing that I'm suggesting at the end of, towards the end of my dissertation is that the moment we speak about music performance anxiety, what we are really denoting is that we are all sitting in the final kind of what in my diagram I paint red as the bad news part of the Jurgensen-Dodson inverted U, where there is too much pressure and the quality of the performance drops. But the reality is that very often we sit backstage, we feel the heart rate, we feel the shallow breath, we
yeah.
feel the heart rate. The you know, we have gone to the bathroom, but all these things are part of the stress response that has woken our body up for optimal performance. And so there's nothing wrong with it, but the moment our students and our fellow musicians sit backstage and they have all these sensations, and then they think something is wrong, I have anxiety, that is where we go wrong.
Mm.
And so one of the things that we checked was actually where it is all sits around productive and unproductive worry. So if we worry up to a certain amount, it's kind of, okay, I'm a little bit worried, I'm going to go and practice again, I've got a concert in 2 weeks' time. I'm going to actually try and kind of address this section and so on. Whereas at what point 5 hours because I'm just giving up.
Yes. Have you found that age has any impact or even gender about who music performance anxiety affects?
Yes, so there's a lot of research around that, and mine is not included, and that's one of the things that we intentionally didn't address. So I had my 18 participants of my study spanned from age 18 to age, I think, 56. And I had 18 of them, so they are kind of scattered all over this timeline of ages. I had a certain amount of males, certain amount of females, and one non-binary participant. And so there was nothing around gender that I was testing. But it is, I don't know how much research there is about age, because a lot of, or the majority of research in this field is done on university students and academy and conservatorium students. But regarding gender, the statistic is very, very clear that women are more prone to suffer from performance anxiety.
Many musicians whom I speak to, and I bring up the subject because it's of great interest to me, lay the blame for this as a lack of preparedness. Is this, do you think, just a lack of understanding or experience which leads them to make such comments? Because we know that over practice leads to other challenges, physical injuries. I even had somebody a couple of weeks ago who said that he practiced so much that he actually physically damaged himself. And it took a lot of undoing and medication and psychology to actually rectify this problem.
Did that interviewee of yours have vocal dystonia?
I didn't go into whether he actually had that, but it's a very interesting aspect. I think it wasn't. It wasn't only focal, it was psychological as well. It was a Russian-trained pianist, and there was he was also without his family. He was very young, left with, you know, sort of 10-hour days, hours of practice a day.
Yes. So the danger of over-practice are actually all over, and the research is, you know, as I'm scared to say that the kind of latest research, because there would have been, you know, in the past month, there would have been another 3 amazing articles around this. It is absolutely clear that this over-practice is dangerous. It is dangerous physically. It is dangerous emotionally. It is dangerous neurologically. Mm. That whole thing of what they do is that they say, oh, yeah, you've got to do this 100 times. This is awful pedagogy that is old pedagogy and should evaporate because it is so dangerous. In terms of neurologically and what I was referring to, if any of your listeners would like to find out about that, that is Eckhard Altenmüller. I think he's in Hanover, but I'm not 100% sure. But anyway, from Germany. And he's... his writing and research shows all over, you know, there were so many musicians along the centuries who, you know, just could not perform anymore because they had, and nobody knew why, and apparently Schumann was another one who had focal dystonia. But what happens with this kind of repetitive practice, especially if there's tension in the hand, is that the brain plasticity creates new connections that are and basically the new connections lock and they no longer have control over individual fingers. That's one of the injuries that can happen, but so many other injuries can happen from this repetitive practice. And so, you know, in my research, what we had done, what we set out to find was the relationships between music performance anxiety and expectancies, between music performance anxiety and the emotional traits and states of people, between that and practice, collaboration, the also how does music performance anxiety influence the whole trajectory, because this was a longitudinal project. This is, I think, the first time that such a project has been done where we check them, and we check their emotions, we check their practice, we check their music performance anxiety, we check all these things continuously from the moment they receive the score.
Yes.
Through the rehearsal, through the performance, until a week later, so they could reflect and they could process and so on. And so the whole trajectory of experience and how music performance anxiety influenced that is what we checked. Now, what we didn't set to study, but just set out to use as a way to gather data, was the practice diary. And the practice diary came out as one of the dominant results.
I wanted to ask you an overview of the project and how you actually found the participants, and whether you used both qualitative and quantitative data in order to garner a better understanding of these questions that you've brought up. How did you find the musicians, and did they know one another?
They didn't. So the whole point of it, one of the things that I wanted to check, and somebody had asked me, but what's the point of doing this as a collaborative, for them to play in collaboration? Wouldn't it have been better to check it in solo? And I think that is a throwback to my old interest in collaborative piano. What I wanted was duos, and one of the things that I wanted to check was how are they before, when they don't know who their collaborator is. And so I went to great lengths to team people together, to put them together when they didn't know one another.
Oh.
And except one couple, one duo that I then heard actually did know one another. And had all these other rehearsals that I had no idea that they were having. Other than them, everybody else was complete strangers. And that, I think, one of the things that we really was really interesting to see was really it's not even how diverse the experience was. I even called it polarity of experience, because you think, you know, these are two people. They are playing together the same 5-minute piece of music. And the experience was so opposite at some of the times, and so different in other times. And the experience of the collaboration, the experience of the performance, of the rehearsal, of, you know, reflection afterwards, perfectionism, everything, their emotions were so different. And it's the same 5 minutes of music. How can that be? But all our data shows that it can.
Yes. Were they all professional musicians?
No. So right. We had some students. We had a few. We had professionals. I had some students, some professionals, and a few amateurs. A few who don't actually make a living out of making music, but really engage a lot in music.
Do you not believe that that could have affected the results? Because somebody who has to play for their living might have a different stress level and approach to somebody who is simply doing it for pleasure.
Yeah, 100%. So in an ideal world, Saskia, I would have had 100 participants, and they would all be of a certain, you know, I would have 50 pianists and 25 singers and 25 instrumentalists.
Yes.
This was an ideal world, but this is Perth we're talking about. And so it was Perth, not only Perth, but Perth mid-pandemic. And so it was difficult
right.
to get participants.
Right.
It was actually so absolutely, if I could run this whole thing again in a bigger center, in somewhere in Europe or somewhere in the States, somewhere that has a huge music school, and I could use the same demographic as in, let's say, all music students and even men and women.
I think this is definitely worthy of more research and of doing it in that way. Definitely. I think
certainly,
that you'll have an incredible response.
And one of the other things that we wanted to check, and we didn't manage because of the timeline, was to check cortisol levels. So we were going to check hormones. We were going to check cortisol and possibly check oxytocin with just tongue swabs and so on. And the timeline was such, as I said, it was in the middle of, it was all done in 2021 and lockdowns were, you know.
But this is also part, this is also part of doing your PhD and being a researcher, isn't it? That as you go through the entire process, you find so many other things coming apart and so many other interests developing as well. And as I was reading your research, I also wondered, did you check whether any of the musicians had other mental afflictions? So, for example, did they have PTSD or ADHD, which could have affected the results or the levels of their stress levels during performance?
Yes, so I didn't check that, and that was, you know, they could withdraw any time. They all not only had my mobile number, my phone number, but they also got a text message from me from phase two when we started checking. I started checking intrusive thoughts 1 week before the performance until 1 week after the performance. And so they all got a text message from me and they could all communicate. So only afterwards, when I was reading the practice diaries, there is one participant in particular who spoke about practice paralysis, that this person was working towards the rehearsal, and then at the beginning of the rehearsal was quite missed that the pianist didn't put really any practice into it. So was quite annoyed at the beginning of the rehearsal, apparently, that you know, he'd put all this practice in, but the pianist hadn't. And then only to discover that the pianist could basically sight read the part, and then he started really stuffing up his part. And for the next probably, I don't know, 5 or 6 days, he said he called it practice paralysis. He basically didn't practice. And of course, had he communicated this to me at any stage, I would have had the conversation, do you want to withdraw, all these other things, but I didn't know that.
Yes.
When you speak about other mental health, you know, issues that any of them are managing or living with, possibly there would be. I do know one participant in the interview had said to me, she had decided to participate because this is her way. Something had happened in the past. She's got this anxiety and freeze problem.
Yes.
And this is what she decided to do in order to get out of it. So the motivation for each one of them would have been probably completely different, but we are not aware. It's not any data that I collected whether they have any other diagnosis or are managing any neurodiversity or any other anxiety issues.
I also found it really interesting that the effects did not only last during the performance, but there was post performance as well.
Yes, absolutely. And I think this is one of the most, you know, when people say to me, what is important for you moving forward, I think this is one of the most important things, because us as musicians, you know, how many times do I go here to our wonderful West Australian Symphony Orchestra and, you know, people would walk off the stage, or any other concerts actually, you know, even at our uni, at the Conservatorium of Music at the University of Western Australia, they, you know, how often do musicians finish the performance, go off the stage into the next, you know, as quick as they can to the next glass of wine?
Yes.
How many do we have? And how many do we have who actually stop and reflect and process and debrief? And how many, on the other hand, how many sports people, how many tennis players, how many soccer teams would actually get a shower and just go home.
Yes, yes.
None of them. They all process and they all analyze and they all talk about it. And whether they analyze only when they have the next training session or they analyze when they're in the dressing rooms and have just walked off, that doesn't matter, but they process it. And that's another, you know, now that this is my field, I keep hearing these stories, and so many people, they have had a lousy performance, and that was the last performance, because this is the impact that it had, or it had a negative performance, effect for many, many performances to go, because they didn't process.
Yes.
And so one of the things that I offer in the Performance Courage Lab is a post-performance tune-down, that people have a conversation after, whether it went well or whether it didn't go well, that they can have that space of a phone call or a face-to-face meeting where they just say, this is what happened, this is how I'm feeling. And, you know, in how many of us, you know, have had a lousy performance and we carry this lousy feeling however long afterwards, because we don't have that space of debrief.
Yes, and of course, musicians have this word called perfectionism. It's something that we strive for.
Yes.
It's never, ever good enough. You always want to be better. And while that's good, it can also be negative. Did the repertoire and the difficulty of the repertoire have any... I mean, was there something that you set that they had to perform?
Yes. So what I did, that's actually, and right at the beginning, I kind of placed that as they're not the same age, they're not the same instruments, they're not
yes.
the same proficiency, level of proficiency. They also didn't have the same repertoire, and this is because I had a whole lot of different combinations of instruments. And so the moment, with logistics, the moment I managed to set all the logistics in, as in, this is the rehearsal time that they could make, I started pairing them together, and then I found the music, basically on imslp.org. And so they didn't have the same music, but even people, you speak about perfectionism, and this is such a good point to raise, Saskia, because perfectionism costs us so much.
Mm.
And it was interesting because, you know, one of the things, you know, as we said before, it was mixed methods. So the questionnaires and surveys that they were filling, which is all the quantitative data, that was the expectancies questionnaires. It was the KMPAI, which is the Kenny Music Performance Anxiety questionnaire. They did the depression and anxiety and stress test. They did the positive and negative affect. And then on the day of performance, that's all before, 2 weeks before, but on the day of performance, what I did was I had, it was kind of, there was the performance, there was the stage, and then off the stage, I had two little rooms backstage.
Yes.
One of them was for before the performance, one of them was for after the performance. And so before the performance, each duo went into the pre-performance little room, and they had two questionnaires. One of them was TIE 6 in order to measure stress and anxiety, but state, not the trait, not how, pardon me, how bad is your anxiety normally or regularly, but right now, how much anxiety are you feeling? And the PANASS F state, which is right now, how positively or negatively are your emotions. And then as soon as they finished those, they went on stage to play. As soon as they finished their performance, their 5 minute or so performance, while the next duo went on stage, they went to the post-performance room, and they did three questionnaires this time. One of them was the reflection questionnaire, but the
yes.
other two were the very, very same, stress and anxiety and positive and negative affect. And the interesting thing was that the people who had higher stress and anxiety after the performance are exactly those participants who throughout the whole process were writing in their practice diary about perfectionism, and the whole time, not
wow.
perfect, or this this is not perfect, or I want this to be perfect. They were the ones who walked away not satisfied and really stressed are the ones who were speaking about before, about perfectionism. And the thing is that when we practice, if we as musicians know how to separate perfectionism, as we need to separate everything around practice to practice and to performance, so if we know when we practice, because who doesn't want a polished performance? Everyone wants the performance to be amazing. Everybody wants to play in tune and cleanly and amazingly. So when we practice, the fact that we practice for perfect is fine. The fact that we aim for perfect is fine, as long as when we are backstage, that is no longer the case. We don't care about that. We care about the music. We care about just playing through and feeling the music and communicating the music and playing for excellence. And whatever the gap is between the best it's been in practice and where it is in performance, we've got to be okay with that.
Were there analogies between the diaries of the participants and then the semi-structured interviews which you conducted later?
Yeah, there were a lot of issues, especially, the whole point of the semi-structured is that I had my 8 questions, but then, you know, some interviews were kind of 25 minutes, some of them were an hour and a half, because there was so much that some of the participants shared. And one of the things that I'd asked them was around actually the practice diary, and the practice diary was really, as I said, it ended up being actually a significant result for this project. But what was interesting is I asked them what impact did the practice diary have on your preparation on the whole process before the leading up to the performance? Because at the performance, the practice diary was there only for phase 1 and 2. In other words, from the day that they got the music until the rehearsal, and then also from the rehearsal until the actual performance. And then at the performance, I collected the diaries back. So for the last week of reflection before the interview, they didn't have the diaries. But when I asked them that, it was really interesting to hear how different people valued the diary for different reasons. And it was also interesting because I had asked, I'd also asked, is there anything that you had done during this this project that you think you would like to take moving forward into your performances? And just about everybody said the diary. But then they said because of different reasons. And so some of them really, you know, wanted, for example, there was a countdown at the top number of days to performance. Some of them were really confronted by that, and they said it really made them quite anxious. Others, they said that was so clear because they had completed that right from the start, and so they would turn the page to today's practice, and suddenly there it is, 8 days before performance or 4 days before performance. There was clarity around that, and it's not that it suddenly kind of bounced on them. Some of them really used the reflection after the practice in order to plan the next day's practice, and they said that was really helpful. So it's not just a to-do list that they tick things off, but rather an opportunity to assess afterwards what did they succeed, what didn't, what can they do tomorrow to help even more. And then there was a note section at the bottom where some of them never put anything, and some of them had a complete emotional debrief every day about how they were feeling.
Moving now to get over music performance anxiety, I see that your performance courage lab must be a way in that direction that you founded and that you're a director of. Can you tell us a little about that? And is it something that you believe teachers need better training in so that they pick it up for their students, and that their methodologies don't actually enhance and precipitate this kind of anxiety?
Absolutely, 100% everything that you said. I feel that we as music teachers, we have a responsibility, we have an opportunity, we have a duty. I think the fact that, you know, so many teachers, because the our students, whether it's, you know, my piano students in my private studio or my university students at the conservatorium, if they, all of them, they kind of, I know that they view me as a teacher as I'm going to solve these problems for them, that I'm their go-to when it's with that. And I think every student goes to their teacher. And I think that a lot, there has been, I am, it's on the tip of my tongue, the name of this extraordinary doctoral project that was done in Melbourne in Australia.
Mm.
I feel awful that I cannot remember, but Margaret Osborne was, I think, the primary supervisor. So the publication actually has got Osborne. I cannot remember the name. But she basically, this in that doctoral research, which is actually an amazing, amazing project, she took music studios and music classrooms and checked what are the teachers teaching, which are the students who feel that they're getting what they need. And basically the end, you know, she absolutely calls for teachers to be more educated around that. And teachers, meanwhile, are thinking, no, I have to go and kind of get them to go and, you know, if it's kind of pathological, then go and see a psychologist. And if it isn't, then, you know, just breathe and perform and off you go.
Mm.
Or take beta blockers, as we heard from, you know, from this acquaintance of mine. And so the reality is that teachers very often feel like they don't have the tools. And so as I was going through this project and I thought, where can I help the most? I felt that the most help that I can do is actually with music teachers. So what I've got is I've got workshops that I do with teachers, and I've done a recent one with a music teachers association here, and I've done a similar one for the Australian Music Examination Board last year. So I do those for teachers. That is a kind of 2-hour workshop of the best tools for students. I also have the workshop that I do with musicians and with music students. And then I've got one which is, I call it an 8x4. It's 8 participants and 4 meetings. That is basically taking the things that I speak about in the 2-hour workshop, but then really digging deep into them and making them more kind of together with the to-do list and actually working on the technicalities of how to do those. And then I've got the Young Performers Pathway, and I've got a Performance Courage Express of 45 minutes. And then, of course, the face-to-face, you know, the individual meetings, including the tune in before performance and a tune down after performance to reflect.
How can somebody who's been listening to the program actually find you or get in touch with you, Gabby?
So the Performance Courage Lab, it's performancecouragelab.com. This is what it's called. I haven't officially launched it because I haven't completed everything that I wanted in the website to go out. So I haven't officially, but it's, you know, I haven't officially launched it, but I keep being invited to give these workshops and presentations. So it's kind of...
It means it's working. That's excellent.
Without being launched.
That's excellent.
But, yeah, it's performancecouragelab.com.
Okay, that's wonderful. Time is against us. It's been fascinating speaking to you, Gabby, and congratulations again on attaining the PhD. I hope we're going to see you doing postdoc studies too.
Yeah. Thank you, and thank you, Saskia, definitely. Thank you for highlighting this as a topic that is so important and so just costing well-being of so many musicians and really needs addressing, and I really appreciate you giving the time for that.
No, thank you for being my guest. Have a wonderful rest of the evening. Thank you.
Thank you. All the best.